Blog Talk Radio.
It is a tremendous honor for the movie geeks to welcome to the show one of our greatest inspirations from the world of cinema, Mr. Brian De Palma. Mr. De Palma, hello.
Thank you for that illustrious introduction.
Well, I heard that you were trying to fill the spot of the young Al Capone, and you were looking for someone strong and sexy, and I just want to throw my hat in the ring.
Absolutely. Send your resume. The problem is I don't think we can raise any foreign money on your name. Maybe wrong.
Give it time.
I could be wrong.
Give it time. You might be able to.
Yes, could be.
Tonight we are honored to have the exceptionally talented writer-director of Canvas, Joseph Greco, and the film star and just one of the greatest actors on the planet, a tremendous treat for all of us, Mr. Joe Pantoliano. Joseph, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
And
hi, Joe.
Hey. Hey, Joey. Happy birthday, Joey.
Absolutely. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
We can't thank you both enough for joining us tonight. It's a great pleasure. I had the pleasure of seeing this movie earlier this year at the Sarasota Film Festival, and I have never seen an audience reaction like it. People were just so incredibly moved by this film, and they really took it into their hearts. And
yeah, well, enough about you. What do you think of me?
It is our great pleasure to welcome producer, director, and author, Mr. John Badham. Mr. Badham, are you with us?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm right here. Thanks so much for having me on your show. It's a terrific show.
All right, let's do it. We are so fortunate on Movie Geeks United to have the opportunity to speak to some of the cinematic idols that have changed our lives, Mr. Bull Goldman. Mr. Goldman, are you with us?
I'm here.
Did you know Pacino was on board, and did you craft those characters with him in mind?
No, not at all. You know, the first choice, you know, I'm probably talking out of school here, was Nicholson for Son of a Woman.
It is a great honor to welcome to our program Mr. John Sayles. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Yeah, you forgot to mention that I was in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest on stage.
That's right.
Yeah, I specialized for a long time in very large, very mentally challenged people. I played Chief Bromden and Lenny and of Mice and Men and people like that.
And here to discuss all of these current and future projects and the ongoing legacy of the Blair Witch Project are Daniel Myrick, Eduardo Sanchez, and Michael Williams. You guys were hit with this enormous success, all three of you, so early in your careers. How does that help you, and how does it hinder you in a way, do you think?
Well, you know, as a filmmaker, we call ourselves artists, and I think we're always looking for respectability. And it's weird. It's just like this double-edged sword with Blair that, you know, there's one group of people out there that think it's like the greatest thing since sliced bread, and it's like they kind of get the movie and so on and so forth. And then there's a whole other seemingly half of the audience that thinks it was a complete, you know, fluke and we got lucky and you know, we're a bunch of talentless schmucks that just were at the right place at the right time. And, you know, and I believe a little bit of that's true on both sides, you know, and you know, there was a lot to do with timing, and we were very lucky. So, you know, as I move through my career and as I've grown and learned, you know, there's certainly a part of me that wants to, like, not only prove to myself, but, you know, also to the general public, like, we aren't just one-hit wonders, and that, you know, we do have talent, and we like to think that we can make normal movies and what have you, but so there is a little bit of that. You'll always be measured up against Blair Witch.
It is truly a great honor to welcome someone who has given so much to the world of cinema and to film fans all around the globe, Mr. Paul Schrader.
Unfortunately, the nature of the crisis is not what movies are about, but what are movies. Mm. We no longer know what movies are. We don't know how long they are. We don't know where you watch them. You don't know whether you interact with them. You don't know whether they have narrative or not. I mean, right. And it's very exciting creatively, but movies are morphing into something else. And like yesterday I went to the movies, and I saw The Bank Job, and I saw three movies. I saw Boleyn Girl, and then I saw Paranoid Park.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was the last movie. I said, well, there's a movie that was made now. You know, that's sort of what's happening now.
Mr. Schrader, do you think the theater-going experience will become obsolete?
No, but it will start to mirror more and more the theatrical experience. It will become more of an event.
You think it will be like the preview, basically? The movie, going to the theater is almost going to be like a really expensive ad for the DVD?
Well, there won't be DVDs.
Oh, that's true. That's going to go, too.
Within 3 years, 4 years, DVDs are gone. You know, you can put them right next to your CDs.
Oh, great. Okay. I'm losing money by the day here.
It's Movie Geeks United, our second year anniversary special.
Happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary. Will you sing to me, Jerry?
We don't want to. We want people to stay tuned to the show. We don't want to.
Let's start
people.
The show off right. Yeah.
Yeah.
You just heard clips from a couple of highlights from our first year on the air. You heard from Brian De Palma, Paul Schrader, John Sayles. Blair Witch Project filmmaker cast reunion show that we did.
Yeah.
John Badham. Did I miss somebody?
I think you got all the.
Yeah,
all
I think
the
that's it.
Ones.
Joey
Pants.
Wells. Yeah, exactly. That was a coup right there.
Yeah,
that was
right there. That was incredible.
That was our Back to the Future episode.
That was.
It's great to be here tonight, everyone. Thanks for listening live, or if you're listening on replay, thank you for that as well. We will be celebrating our second year on the air. It's actually tonight, to the date.
That's right.
Tonight. A little bit later in the show, we'll be bringing on Blog Talk Radio's own Oscar host and our good friend Jason O'Brien. He will come on and he will interview us about the history of our show and the personal highlights for us.
Right.
That's going to be fun. And lots of second-year highlight clips will be played as well. Are you hearing static on my phone? Is it bad?
I hear it, and it could be from my phone, too, so I'm not going to worry about it. I wouldn't worry about it. I think it's fine.
Okay.
If it gets really bad, I think people will tell us in the chat room.
Yes.
I hope so.
Yeah. It's been some technical difficulties here and there on Blog Talk mm-hmm. Radio lately, but we're on tonight, which is all that matters.
That's right.
Great show for you. We're going to start out with an interview with a great character actor. Actually, first, Jerry, how have you been, man?
I've been okay. You know, I've been looking forward to this show for a couple of days now, actually for a couple of weeks ever since we talked about it. So we were talking about it earlier, and this should be a lot of fun. And we're bringing Jason on, so that's always a good time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Our show is so good, even Jason can't bring it down.
Jason O'Brien has been like
I'm
a
so
really
sorry,
nice
Jason.
Addition. He's been a nice addition to the show. I
love Jason. He's an honorary geek through and
he
through.
He is.
Okay, let us begin with our first interview. This is a great actor. His name is James Rebhorn, and if you don't know the name, you certainly know the face and the talent. So many films, including Scent of a Woman, Carlito's Way, The Game. Meet the Parents, just a wealth of great credits under his belt. And he's one of those guys where the second you see him in a movie, you feel absolutely comfortable with him, and you know at least you're going to get a strong performance from him.
That's right.
Yeah, he's just a brilliant actor. He can play anything, really. And his new movie is called Don McKay, and it's a very interesting-sounding thriller.
Mm-hmm.
With a great cast, Tom and Hayden Church and Emmett Walsh and a few other great people.
And it premieres at the Tribeca Film Festival, which the opening night of that one is the 22nd of this month.
It's coming up. It's quicker than I thought. Wow, okay.
Yeah, it's very quick. So look out for it. It's called Don McKay, and he's also featured in the new Richard Kelly movie, The Box.
That's in October or November. That should be awesome.
Yes, his follow-up to Southland Tales.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to follow up anything, it should be Southland Tales.
That's right.
I know you love that movie.
I love that movie. I adore that movie. So.
And we love James Rebhorn. Our good friend Aaron was able to pull this interview off for us today. Jerry and I weren't able to attend. Actually, you were, Jerry, but we were unaware of that.
Yeah, we were unaware that I was calling in.
We're all discombobulated this morning, but...
Yeah.
He's a great talent, and we're so honored to have him on the show. Here's James Rebhorn.
What was your earliest memory of you thinking, you know, I think I want to be an actor?
I certainly in high school, I thought it might be fun to be in a play, and I was in a play, but I don't think at that point I was seriously thinking about making a career of being an actor. I don't think I really seriously thought about being a professional actor until I was in my second year of drama school. And then I thought, well, maybe I should give it a try. I'm here in New York City. I'll give it a shot, and I've been very, very fortunate.
What was your, your plan before that? What were you thinking?
Well, I went to, I got a Master of Fine Arts, so I was thinking I would probably teach. But I remember when I applied to drama schools, I applied to only schools that conferred degrees, MFAs. Thinking I would teach, and the one I went to was Columbia, and my decision really was based on the fact that it was in New York City. I thought, well, if I'm getting a degree in acting, I might as well do it in the center of the acting universe in New York City. So,
at the time, did you think theater was going to be the main thing, or did you think?
Well, I don't think I really, you know, when you're 21, I don't know that you really. I mean, I didn't certainly have any. Any long-range plans. I just thought I would, theater always seemed, that's what my experience was, and that was where my interest was, certainly initially, and it still is, which is why I still live on the East Coast, mm-hmm. so I can still do theater.
Right.
So it was certainly, you know, something that was important to me, and still is.
You know, a lot of actors who start off on doing the theater, you know, they always say that, you know, they always talk about going back. You know, to kind of recharge the batteries and so forth. And do you feel that's the same for you?
Yeah, well, I do. I mean, I don't, to me, it's not, I was never looking at it as starting off in theater and then going on to television and movies. In many ways, television and movies are far less satisfying for the actor, it mm-hmm. seems to me. They are usually more lucrative, but in terms of acting, I think theater is always going to be the actor's medium because, you know, I mean, there is a stage director, and they certainly manage the movement on the stage, and they certainly can be insightful in terms of overall concept for a production and can be very helpful to an actor. But finally, it's just you and the audience. You know, there's nothing in between. In film, it's very much the director's medium. You mm-hmm. know, the director is the one who sets up the shots, who finally has control over the edit and the final cut and all that. It's very much a director's medium. And in television, an argument can be made that it doesn't belong to either the actors or the directors, but to the producers, the creators of the show, that everybody else is just sort of the hired gun to make the producer's vision come to life. So I think for an actor, and I certainly would not have been able to work in film or theater had I not had some sense of what it was to act in a play where you go from beginning, middle to end, you know. But I think for an actor, I mean, theater is always the place where it's at.
Right. You started going into that, I guess, the television stuff pretty early on, I guess in the mid-70s.
Again, you know, it wasn't like I had any real plan. It's just, you know, my agent would send me out for things, and I would, fortunately, book some of these auditions, and it's just the way it happened. Early in the 70s and early in my career when I was doing theater here in New York and also around the country. I was also doing commercials, but I also did a lot of daytime television.
Right.
And, I had a great time doing it. I feel very fortunate to have had that opportunity.
Since, I guess, film is kind of the dominant medium, I guess, for audiences, you came out of the gate for some people, I guess, in the early 90s is when you started really popping up in kind of these, you know, these high level, these high marquee films.
Yeah,
you were having all these character parts.
Yeah, I think probably the two films that kind of got me recognition in the industry were two movies that were released within, I think, a month of each other. One was Scent of a Woman, and the other was Lorenzo's Oil. And
right.
Both those movies were successful in different ways. Lorenzo's Oil was a substantial artistic success, and Scent of a Woman was a substantial financial success. But
right.
I think from that point on, people, when they heard my name, were able
yeah.
to associate it with a face they had seen on screen.
Right. Well, I want to ask you about Sin of a Woman. More, I guess, the Sin of a Woman / Carlito's Way, in that you
uh-huh.
did two films with Al Pacino.
Yeah.
Being a theater person, you know, and Al's also, you know, Pacino's also from the theater and goes to film and so forth. What was that like to see, you know, to have those scenes? I guess particularly in Sin of a Woman, you get to see Pacino do a big monologue.
Yeah, I say Al, I don't mean to imply that I know him well enough to be, you know, close friends with him, but you know, when you're working with somebody, you call him by your first name. Yeah,
right.
But he's a very shy guy, so I don't know that I found that his background in theater made it any easier for either of us to work with each other. It's, you know, for most actors, especially those that, you know, are kind of centered on the East Coast, they're
right.
almost always doing a little theater at the same time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I can't say that it really informed our relationship or our working relationship in any special way.
Right. And the one film I do want to talk about, and I remember when this film came out, your appearance in it came out, there were actually, this is when, you know, you saw some pieces written about, you know, where's this guy from and so forth, and that's David Fincher's The Game.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
From 97. I vividly remember you play the guy ahead of the,
yeah.
the game thing, and you have a great sequence where Michael Douglas, you're basically, you're inadvertently kind of bossing him around, and you got this upside-down pineapple sponge cake in a bag, and you're making him hold it, and he's giving you dirty looks of why am I even holding this? And so I'm curious on that experience of that particular role, which you only have a couple of scenes, but I know you made a big impression on a lot of audiences with that particular character.
Well, I had a great time working on it. I had met previously, David Fincher. He had hired me to do a Madonna video, and which he did a lot of music videos back when
right.
he was starting out. And prior to that, I had met him and auditioned for him for Alien 3, a movie which was kind of like his first big
right.
you know, studio film. And although I didn't get the role, I did think he responded, you know, well to me. And
mm-hmm.
I think when The Game came along, he just saw that role as something I could do. And I did go in and audition for him, but I think he already had me pretty much in mind for that role, which was very flattering. And it was great fun. And Michael Douglas is terrific to work with. We had a good time. The only thing I would say is that we did a lot of night shooting, and that was only because that was when the locations were available. And I hate night shooting.
Right. Well, you bring that up. I got to back up a second. So, are you saying you were in a Madonna video, or did
I was? Yeah, I was in a Madonna video. The name of I can't remember what it was. I think if you go to internet movie database, it tells you, you know, what it was. I don't think I ever saw it because I don't really watch.
Well, I got to ask, there's an interesting thing. I mean, you do theater, you do television, you do film. What's it like doing a music video?
Well, I approached it as if I was doing a little film, and I think probably, you know, I'm not unique in that. I think probably most actors do. You know, it was a little, just a little movie.
Right.
So and it was fine.
I'll ask this about directing, and that you've worked with, you know, you've worked with De Palma, with Fincher, you've worked with Woody Allen, Ridley Scott, and the list goes on, and, you know, these are some real heavy hitters, George Miller and so forth, Michael Cimino. So I got to wonder, is there anything common, a common thread between the good directors and the not-so-good directors? Is there something that separates the two?
No, I don't think so. You know, it continues to be a mystery. Film continues to be a mystery to me, even though I've done so many of them. I don't know why some work and some don't, and I don't always know that it's the director that makes it work and doesn't make it work. I would say personally, generally, and I've enjoyed working with every director I've worked with, and I mean that sincerely, but I think as an actor, the ones that I generally enjoy working with more are the ones that have had some theater background. I think they have, because of that, a vocabulary for dealing with actors that other directors who have, and I don't mean to put down film schools by saying this, but who have trained exclusively in film schools or who came from being editors or from assistant directors, don't necessarily have. And I think particularly of Anthony Minghella, the late Anthony Minghella, who was sensational to work with. And he, of
right.
course, came from a theater background, had written plays and all that. And Mike Nichols is another one. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, but again, I'm not, all the other directors I've had a great time working with in there, and some of them have been particularly helpful to me in my acting in films.
Right.
But Anthony Minghella certainly has been, was an extraordinary man.
Wow, yeah. Well, let's talk a little about this movie, Don McKay. And,
yeah.
The cast is pretty spectacular. I mean, Thomas Hayden Church, Elizabeth Shue, which we
yeah.
haven't seen, the amazing Melissa Leo.
Yeah.
Keith
and
David.
Jake Goldberger was terrific. He was a terrific director. He's a young guy, and he's got great instincts, and he was wonderful.
He was really terrific. Tell us a little about the film, and that not only about, I guess, you know, what is the film, but also how did it get to you, and what drew you to it?
Well, my agent called me up and said, there's a script we'd like you to read, and I think there's some interest in them offering you a role, and I read it. I liked it very much. And it fit in nicely with my schedule because it was only a couple of days that I worked on the film, and it was right before I was to go into rehearsal for a play.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, actors, even though they like doing plays, or at least this actor does, you don't make any money doing plays. So I was grateful to have a film job that paid me some money before I went into rehearsal for a play.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked it a lot. You know, it's hard to it's not an easy film to explain. It's sort of a coming home. I guess I could say it's sort of a coming home drama,
mm-hmm.
but it's a very black drama, and it's also kind of a black comedy.
Right.
And I'm not gonna, if I say too much about my role in it, I'm gonna
okay
the story. I
okay, no, that's fine. That's fine.
But
well,
let's just say I play quote unquote a doctor in the film.
Okay.
And that's about as far as I can go, I think.
Well, I guess maybe let's see if you can answer that. You said you only have a couple of days in the film, so I guess you only have a few scenes. Who do you share your scenes with, and what are those?
I had the very good fortune of working exclusively with Thomas Hayden Church and with Melissa Leo and Elizabeth Shue, and I had previously worked with Elizabeth years ago in a TV miniseries called Amy and Isabel.
Right, right, right.
So we had some experience together, but I had never worked with Thomas or with Melissa, and they were terrific. Tom particularly, he was a lot of fun. I had more to do with him than anybody.
Is there a difference or a preference or an impression working with a veteran director or someone who's relatively new to the game? I mean, this film is the director is relatively new.
Yeah.
Is there a difference, or is there an excitement level, or?
Well, I think, that's an interesting question. I think generally the younger directors are working in smaller independent films, and they're frequently using high def digital technology,
mm-hmm.
so that everything is kind of shot and happens a lot quicker and kind of off the cuff. And in some ways, for me, I find that kind of more exciting because everybody's dealing from their first impulse. And one of the first lessons you learn in acting school, or I did anyway, was that you should always trust your first impulse.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sometimes in a big film, and that's not doesn't mean the big films aren't going to be any good, but sometimes there's so much thought put into everything and rethought and rethinking and rewrites and this and that, that it gets so you get so removed from the actual creative process that you feel like you're plugging into some great grand vision that's already been laid out. Whereas
right.
when you're working with a young director, and this is only because young directors don't have money to do all these kind of things, everybody's got to work very hard and very quickly and trust their first impulse. And that's very exhilarating.
Mm-hmm.
So
well, and,
but, I mean, in terms of the skill level, it's interesting. I think young directors are frequently just as skilled as veteran directors.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also on Sunday, you know, your interview will air tonight, but on Sunday we're going to have Emmett Walsh, who's also in the film. And,
yeah.
And I think you've worked with him. I guess you don't have any scenes in this film, but I think you've worked with him before.
I did, yeah. I worked in I think it was an ABC After School special.
Right.
We worked together, and it was nice to see him. And Keith David is, he's an old friend from stage. We did Othello at the New York Shakespeare Festival at the theater in the Central Park, the Delacorte Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've known him for a long time.
So, and what's coming up next?
I'm working on this is not a long term commitment, but I am doing a radio play for WNYC Radio, Public Radio here in New York City.
Wow.
And that'll just be a couple of days. You know, we're gonna tape it, and then actually we're gonna also do it live. It'll be a live broadcast as well, so that's very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have The Box coming out later in the year.
Right, right.
And at the moment, that's it.
Is there a performance or a couple of performances you've seen the last, I guess, maybe year, whether it's stage or film, that have really kind of, you know, stood out for you?
Well, I would say the entire production on stage of a play called August, Osage County. I saw the original cast of that, and that was an extraordinary production, and that certainly has stayed with me.
Right.
And I, you know, in film, actually, the movie The Wrestler was Mickey O'Rourke's performance, and that was extraordinary. So that stood up. And also, I thought Wendy and Lucy was a very special film, too.
Right, right. And I guess, and my final question is kind of the fun one, if it applies, is there whenever one of your films comes out, is there a particular character or, you know, someone every now and then they'll stop you on the street for?
You know, it's interesting, and again, I think this is because I have been fortunate enough to do things in television and film and in theater. You know, especially in the New York City area, people sometimes stop me for plays they've seen me in. Sometimes they stop me for a character called Bradley Raines, which I did on Guiding Light like 20 years ago, 23 years ago. You know, it's funny, you know, and then I would say The Game is a frequent stopper, but, you know, just the other day I was in a store and somebody stopped me for Meet the Parents. So, you know, it really, there's no way to tell. I wouldn't say that there's one thing in particular that people stop me for.
Well, Mr. Rebhorn, and, you know, we love your work. You're one of our favorite character actors.
Oh, thank you.
And we really look forward to Don McKay, and please come back anytime you have anything in the theater or on film coming out and you want to talk about it.
Thank you, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, too.
All right, James Rebhorn, his movie that premieres at Tribeca, I am told by a very reliable source in our chat room, on Friday the 24th, is Don McKay, and it features a really great cast.
We should
alongside.
Have a field trip and go there.
I'd love to go to Tribeca.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to just go from festival to festival, like I'm part of a circus or something.
Yes, it would be great. It would be wonderful. Not have to worry about money or anything. Just wonderful. You
and,
think I'm joking. I'm
to
not.
Live in a land made of chocolate.
And cheese.
We're big dreamers on this show.
We're big dreamers, and some of those comments about the blind leading the blind in the chat room are a little bit too much. But
yeah. Anyway, while we're waiting for our next guest to come on the line, Jerry, does it feel like 2 years? It's okay if you say it does.
No, it doesn't. It really feels like more like 2 months.
Really?
It really doesn't feel like 2 years has gone by at all. I mean, it just feels like yesterday we were, like, chatting this thing up. I mean,
it really
doesn't feel like 2 years at all.
Well, it kind of does to me, but that's not a bad thing, because I enjoy the heck out of it. But just to give you a sense of everyone a sense out there, we've done, I think this is the 194th show. We've had almost 400 guests in that amount of time. So a lot of highlights for us,
mm-hmm.
and I've picked maybe up to 10 or so big highlights to play during our two-year anniversary discussion that will take place in a few moments with our good buddy Jason O'Brien.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward to that.
Yes, I am too.
I can't ask you anything because I'm going to steal Jason's thunder. And
yeah, we don't want to do that because then he'll get really upset and he'll probably throw things at us if he ever sees us in person. So
we'll make sure that never happens.
Yeah.
tell me what comes out this weekend. Are you planning to go see something this weekend?
I want to go see State of Play this weekend, that new Russell Crowe movie.
Yeah.
I've read like good reviews of and bad reviews of, and what else? Crank, High Voltage looks like a lot of fun. But there's some smaller movies I want to see that are playing around here, too. Like, I still want to see Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to see The Mysteries of Pittsburgh finally open. So
I'd
like to try to see that. But I don't know if that's going to. I don't know if I'll get to see that one. But
The Skarsgård
movie,
right?
That's the one. That's a great book by Michael Chabon. I read that a long time ago. But I thought that was going to come out like last year, because that was at last year's Sundance, and the reception to it was mixed at best.
I haven't really read anything but lukewarm critical reviews of it, but that's the thing about independent film now. It has a long kind of gestation period before it sees some of these films see the light of day,
mm-hmm.
I've noticed, more and more. It's just a big journey to finding the proper distribution. I believe our next guest is on the line, and this is an exciting conversation. We're going to talking about a very exciting actor. Let me just let everyone know, we have another one of our great character actors on the show on Sunday. And I was told by his publicist, this is very special. He never does interviews. He hates talking about himself. So I just plan to talk about myself to him.
I hate talking about myself, too, so that makes two of us. So I can't stand myself. So this
but
is
he,
gonna be...
He knows how much we love him, so
yes.
He's coming on. Mr. M. Emmett Walsh, something like 150 to 200 credits. He's in everything. He's such a major part of movies, and he's a quintessential character actor. And so that'll be a very interesting interview. That should be a lot of fun for us and all of our listeners. I tell you who another quintessential character actor is, Warren Oates. And
yes.
Warren Oates wrote a massively successful and creative wave throughout the 60s and the 70s in films like the Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, The Wild Bunch, Two Lane Blacktop, Cockfighter, Badlands.
Badlands. Let's see, what the other one, The Shooting, you said Two Lane Blacktop, and there's, you know, let's not forget Stripes in the early 80s, the one, like,
yes.
flat-out comedy he did. And the other, if I'm not mistaken, he's also in Race with the Devil with Peter
yes.
Fonda, which is the first thing I remember seeing him in, and that was the late 70s.
Yes, good stuff.
Yeah.
He was an unlikely star if there ever was one. He's an outlaw, really. But
yeah.
I think that's exactly what made him so magnetic
mm-hmm.
on screen. Susan Campo's new book, Warren Oates, A Wild Life, explores this icon of the cinema in vivid, entertaining, and insightful detail. Ms. Campo, who previously made a huge splash with her passionate writings on the music scene and her novels, including Life After Death and Other Stories and Pretty Things, had none other than Charles Bukowski call her a pretty girl with a dirty mind. And that's exactly why she's with us tonight.
That's right, because I love it. If everyone knows me, I worship Bukowski, so there
you
go.
It's a little attempt at humor. This is a great book. You can purchase it on our homepage by clicking the icon of the front cover there. It'll take you directly to the Amazon page where you can purchase it for yourself. I highly recommend it. It's a great privilege to welcome Susan Campo to Movie Geeks United. Susan, are you with us?
I am.
Welcome.
Hi. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Oh, it's great fun. Already, or so far.
Well, no, you said it best.
Tell me, obviously you have a great passion for writing. Where did that begin for you?
Oh, gosh, right. My story, I mean, I suppose growing up in Orange County, California, with not a lot else of interest going on.
Right.
I always loved to write. I think I began writing by making fun of the kid in the seat next to me in the second grade, that kind of thing. So maybe not.
Good for you.
But that got me going, you know.
and so when did that turn to kind of an obsession with music?
Gosh, probably in the kind of hippie, James Taylor-y, Beach Boys days, the latter Beach Boys, and then into David Bowie after
mm-hmm.
that
oh,
punk
yeah.
rock, the usual progression.
yeah. And so you've written about music, like we mentioned before, and you've written novels, and which came first for you? Did you want to do a biography and then the idea for Warren Oates came, or was it vice versa?
I always kind of wanted to do a biography, and I suppose probably the very first thing was poetry, and then I thought, I don't want to starve, you know.
That's what happened to me, so.
I understand, you know.
Yeah.
And then I had always thought, who am I going to write a biography of? And a friend of mine said, well, why not Warren Oates? And I thought, well, there's an idea.
Mm-hmm.
What was your consciousness of Warren Oates at that time before you ventured on this biography?
Well, I'd gone to the drive-in to see Two Lane Blacktop because of James Taylor and Dennis Wilson, and then came away incredibly impressed with Warren Oates.
Yeah,
I forgot about the other two entirely. So.
What was it about him in that film? What was it that like made you forget about these two people who originally came for the movie, and then what was it about Warren?
I suppose just the kind of the fact that he really dominates the film. I mean,
he does.
Kind of absolute passion.
Right.
And I mean, people do say he's the only actor in the film. I don't know that I. Well, you know, it's arguable. I suppose we could say he is.
Mm-hmm.
But he still is, well, Harry Dean's in it, but he still just stands out so much.
Right.
Kind yeah.
of real feel,
yeah.
I guess.
He always seemed like the most interesting character actors, which I don't even know if I agree with that terminology. I understand what character actor means. It's just I think all actors play characters. But
I wish I understood it. You know, I don't quite.
I think by today's standards, maybe, I don't want to, almost derogatory, because we're assuming these are actors that could never get on the cover of GQ or Men's Health. They're not the kind of actors who are, what did you do to get in shape for this part? It's not like, how did you rehearse, but how many ab exercises did you do? And that's sadly what is the state of, I think, the entertainment in that regard, and the press and everything. Hey, what's your workout routine for T2 or whatever?
Oh,
you know,
yeah, that probably wouldn't have worked for Warren.
he didn't have to deal with that.
No,
but like all the great, interesting character actors, for me, he seemed an unlikely movie actor. He was born in a small Kentucky town. I understand he was a Marine.
Yes.
What drew him to performance? What did that do for him?
Well, he played a part as a little kid in a school play, again, sort of age 5 or 6, reciting, "I wish I was a cat, I do." And he kind of credits that as getting him going, but then really kind of retreating from, well, being picked on. I think that he started reading books and plays and wanting to do something else. And also he retreated, I mean, like many young kids, he got really interested in movies, going to see the movies in the nearby town of Greenville, Kentucky, and coming back to his town of DePoy and acting out all the parts for the other kids who didn't get to go to the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So what was his entry into film?
Well, it would have been early TV, you know. It would have been early done in the live days of TV in New York City. But the first film, it must have been up Periscope. I'm hoping I'm not getting this wrong. In 1959.
Right.
That would have been the first actual film, but he did TV work before then, and I guess that.
The Gunsmoke and things like that.
Yeah, many, many Gunsmokes.
Yes.
Yeah. And he had that, like I said in the intro, he had a kind of outlaw. There was something about him that said outlaw to me and so many others. Was that his particular niche? Is that what made him so magnetic to people on screen?
Yeah, I think so, and I think he was always a little bit different from everyone around him. And he was certainly a dedicated actor, but he was not an egotistical actor in any way.
Yeah,
no, not at all, yeah.
Yeah, and that's kind of unusual for now, certainly, and for then as well.
Yeah, and he was. How did he train? Did he have a lot of training in theater and so forth?
Yeah, he did at the University of Louisville. That he come back from the Marines and joined the college. And a teacher who had him as a recalcitrant student in an English class said, you know, we need someone like you acting in our play. So he went down and tried out for the part and just absolutely got hooked. And then when he moved on to New York City, he trained with Wynne Handman in New York, who I know is still around and still highly of Warren. And I think it, I mean, it was really formal training, which I don't know how many people know that watching Warren. They may have thought he's a kind of
geek
who was able to pull it off, and it is absolutely not true. He really studied and took all the parts seriously.
That's very much one of the main points that I was taken by in your book, in that he, if you were on the set with him, you knew this was a serious, trained actor.
Oh, yes.
And I think watching him, he feels so authentic. He's the real deal. I mean, you know it watching him. How did he live his life off the screen? What was he like off the screen?
I think with a whole lot of passion. I think either, you know, out with the nightlife every night, living it to the nth degree, or perhaps, you know, at home, maybe still living it, or at home studying a script and kind of retreating.
Yeah, yeah.
A little bit of both, but certainly big extremes, but with the great passion between the both.
Yeah. Talk about a passionate collaboration. You can't think about Warren Oates, his film career, without thinking of Sam Peckinpah. I mean, epic collaboration there.
Yeah,
certainly.
That was an interesting relationship, a real love-hate kind of relationship, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I suppose it was a kind of, like I say, a fatal friendship. I mean,
yeah.
Probably neither
that's
was,
one way to put it, yeah.
Yeah, neither was really good for the other, but thank God they were friends. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What did they, how did they complement each other, and what made them clash?
Well, I think they were both, I mean, they were certainly both ex-Marines,
mm-hmm.
and they both had lost their fathers at critical stages in their lives. And I think they both really cared about what they were doing. I think Sam took it to a far greater extreme and could turn a whole lot meaner than Warren could. And that's what, you know, would divide them at times. I mean, Sam certainly turned on everybody. He didn't turn on Warren to the extreme. He turned on others in his life,
right.
But he still was nasty enough to, you know, go after Warren's widow, Warren's last wife,
right,
and cause a schism there, definitely.
There's a great quote that Warren Oates has about describing Peckinpah. He said, "I don't think he's a horrible maniac. It's just that he injures your innocence, and
yes.
you get pissed off about it."
Yeah, I love that. It's beautiful, and it's also very Warren to see that. It's
yes,
mm-hmm. yeah, very very touching. Yeah, I don't know that Sam would have seen it quite that way, but
no, I don't think he would have.
Warren really did.
Yeah.
And yet, he seemed the perfect director for Warren because Warren liked strong, argumentative directors, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He didn't want someone that he could push around. He thought
yeah.
if he could push around his director, he just didn't have that much confidence in the director then. It would kind of, you know, shy away from giving it his all.
Right.
Mm.
Yeah.
For you, is there a quintessential Warren Oates performance?
I like different ones on different days of the week. I mean, I liked all the
yeah.
ones you said in the intro. I like the Hired Hand on certain days.
That's a good one.
Certainly Alfredo Garcia.
Mm-hmm.
Dillinger.
Dillinger, he is the, you know, after, you know, we have him and Lawrence Tierney, and those are two big Dillingers to, you know, that Johnny Depp is going to have to measure up to, I think, so.
Yeah, I think it's odd that Johnny Depp, as a Kentuckian, has never, as far as I know, referenced Warren Oates, and I don't know why, you know?
Yeah,
yeah.
It's puzzling. Lawrence Tierney was certainly a whole lot meaner, I think.
Oh, he was a mean man.
He certainly was. He was an interesting man.
He was, yes.
Definitely.
That's the next biography.
Yeah. That would be fun. You know,
yeah.
Poor old Jack Lord, who gets such a pasting in my book.
Tell me about the journey in actually writing this book. When you called Warren's collaborators, friends, family, did you get a particularly warm reception? Were they eager to discuss him?
Yeah, everybody. People I thought probably wouldn't, you know, be able to have time, just kind of cleared the books, just saying, let's talk about Warren. And it was really, really nice, and I didn't expect that. People really, they and the memories, like I said, they were very vivid. They were as if they were yesterday.
Yeah.
It was like one
yeah.
of a faded character, like he was right here.
Was there a highlight for you from that experience?
Oh, I think, I mean, Dennis Hopper was wonderful. I mean, even though the memories might not be ultra vivid. In a way, it kind of worked. In a way, that almost fed it, you know, because what he
yeah.
did remember was so important, you know. And so good at remembering all the minutiae. You remember what mattered. And lots of good things. I regret I never got Peter Fonda, but for some reason I didn't.
Mm.
I don't know. Maybe he's tired of talking about Warren or found it too painful. I don't know.
Warren passed on in, was it 82?
82, yes.
Yeah. I think something like Blue Thunder might have been one of his last films that was dedicated to him.
Yeah, and probably I think Tough Man was the actual.
Yeah, Tough.
Okay.
I think it's either Blue Thunder or Tough Enough. They're both.
Tough Enough. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me what his legacy is in your eyes, and let me first of all tell you, I love it that you've written a book about Warren Oates because, you know, there are biographies on other talents of the yin-yang, but there's nothing on Warren Oates.
Right.
And I love these books, like the one that was just released on Hal Ashby.
Yes.
This is the kind of cinematic history we need. We need to keep these works alive.
Oh, well, thank you. It's interesting that only university publishers will nibble, and thank God they do. I mean,
yeah.
Great.
Oh.
Great company.
I tried everything, and if people say, oh, no, might be my favorite actor, but there's no place on the crowded biography shelves.
But there needs to be this, because, you know, like, it's the only one out there, and it needs to be there. I mean, it really does.
Yeah.
What do you think his legacy will be, or is?
I think a very real presence. I mean, I think one of my, what was it, Wynne Handman, his acting teacher, said he had, you know, you could feel the American dirt in his acting. He really could. Mm-hmm. I mean, this kind of presence, the dedication to the craft, and also the fact that he was really, he was kind of ahead of his time and also kind of timeless. I don't know if those two are the same things, but, I mean, when I was writing it, and I could see he was really interested in Zen and road trips and this, that, and the other, which seemed really contemporary, but at the time would not have particularly been. So, and these performances that still resonate. I mean, I don't know that there was a bad one. If I watched Drum, I could probably say, well, he's probably not given his best performance in that one, but.
Yeah. And he was one of a kind, obviously, but looking at the stars and the actors of today, is there anyone out there that's comparable to what he had?
I'm not sure. I know the young actor Joseph Gordon-Levitt is a big fan, and I think there's every now and then I see something of Warren in him.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I mean, they're probably the more obvious fans, like Benicio del Toro. I think he's good. I'm not sure I see Warren in him particularly.
Right.
And beyond that, I don't know. Do you? I mean,
there's only one actor I could think of, not as maybe who would might have been considered a contemporary.
Yeah.
Fred Ward, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I would see him, but as far as today, Joshua Gordon-Levitt, I could see that. I can see that, but I was just thinking Fred Ward really was the last of those actors who would remind me of Warren Oates.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, because this is interesting in that it doesn't seem that we have the personalities in cinema like we used to. I mean, Warren Oates was, like I said before, a real authentic personality. Is there... how did he take to fame?
I think he was reticent about it. I think he may have wanted to be a bigger actor and have more leading roles than he did, but I think he didn't like the stardom. He didn't understand it. I mean, he wasn't confronted with anything like he would have been today. I mean, I think if he were running around today, he and Peckinpah, TMZ, would have put them out of business. I mean, they could have never gone out, ever, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Maybe part of it is that. Maybe part of it is as we get further away from you know, roots like that. I don't know. Little towns that were little mining towns or that kind of thing. I don't know where actors come from with that kind of background anymore.
Yeah. And the fact of the matter is, I've said this before on the show, you don't have to be exceptional to be a star now. I mean,
so
it doesn't have to be anything particularly exceptional about you.
Sounds like you have to be mediocre, really, to be exceptionally mediocre to be a star.
You kind of move them in, move them out. I think they're all kind of replaceable, which is sad.
Yeah.
It is.
But your book is essential in keeping this man and his work alive, and I thank you so much for it. And please come back anytime in the future. We love having you on.
Oh, yes,
thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Absolutely.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
Have a good evening.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Good night. Bye.
Bye.
Susan Campo, the book is Warren Oates, A Wild Life. Purchase it here on our homepage. or actually in a bookstore. They still have bookstores, Jerry, right?
Yes, I used to. I've worked in so many, yes, so I might actually, I'm going to go to my bookstore and buy it.
It's hard to believe, but those still exist. I've read where teenagers actually, well, not teenagers, exclusively, people actually upload books on their Palm Pilot or whatever they carry.
The Amazon, the Kindle now, is that the device?
Yes.
Amazon, the Kindle.
Exactly.
I know. It's amazing.
It's a new world. I never thought that I'd feel old. I feel
obsolete because I still love to hold a book and read it. So
yeah, I tell you one thing. We're 2 years old. Talking about age. This is our second year anniversary tonight. First of all, let me take a call. I think this is Aaron on the line, and then we'll bring on Jason. Hang on, Aaron.
Hey guys, what's
up?
Hey, buddy.
Great job on the interview.
Yeah, I want to thank you for doing that interview, man.
Thank you
so much. Wanted to check in. You know, it's 2 years. I've been a part of the show, I guess, fall of...
Fall
of 07.
We interviewed you about the critics and stuff, all the interviews you did with the critics. Yeah, that was a great show.
Yeah, so I guess it's been about 18 months.
And that has led to your own highly successful show.
My own highly successful show. In fact, I'd like to think that the Movie Geek United took off after I joined.
I know you'd like to think that.
In fact, you know what? I am going to think that. And I don't care if the numbers just prove it, but I'm going to think that anyways.
You got to do what you got to do.
I guess, yeah.
What has been a highlight for you? Just knowing me? Is that what it is?
Oh my God,
you too.
That's an obvious highlight, knowing you, knowing Jerry.
Yeah.
In spirit, knowing Chris.
Mm-hmm.
Shout out to Babs for Chris. Gotta love Babs. I guess as far as interview wise, I mean, I love this. I guess I love the stuff that obviously I coordinated with, for Movie Geeks United, I guess, or particularly, I guess, Edelstein to talk about Dirty Harry.
That was good. And also when we had Glenn Kenny on,
Glenn Kenny on for the summer,
mm-hmm.
Glenn's a lively guy.
Oh, he's a great guy.
Matt Zoller Seitz to talk about Rambo.
That was another
and
good
also,
one.
Having on Henry Sanders for Killer of Sheep, which was,
mm-hmm.
I know that was kind of a little maybe not as mainstream a title that sometimes we cover on Movie Geek United, but it was an important title. And I guess I'm proud of the fact that, and that Jamie was immediately receptive to this, and that, we love movies, we love going to the movies, but, we also... Jamie and I were realists in that most people, the majority, the vast majority of people, their big experience of seeing movies is actually now at home. That's
mm-hmm.
the choice that they make, and so therefore, home entertainment is the not only the final word of a lot of our favorite films, but is where most people are seeing films, whether it's the mainstream stuff or they're discovering obscure stuff or classics and so forth. And so, I am proud that we had this. Home entertainment, apparatus to the show that
mm-hmm.
I still contribute to, and Jamie, allows me to come on
yeah.
not only to cross promote
yeah,
my
no,
show,
it's,
but
it's
also
very
to,
important.
to do the reviews. I would say the highlight of that, and this is obviously a personal one because I still think it's probably going to be the best film of the decade. I guess is interviewing James Vanderbilt for the screenwriter of Zodiac.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was very good.
That was cool, and I don't think we would have, obviously that's an interview that that we got just shortly after we started doing home entertainment, and so I think because we started doing a home entertainment, it did open up to a whole new avenue of interviews, and so talking to Vanderbilt, because along with Fincher's obvious direction, that screenplay is also something that should be. Studied in that it has.
Oh,
I wanted to speak to Vanderbilt, I mean, he called me an hour before the show and said, "Let's do it." So,
yeah, I mean, that screenplay, some of us have seen Zodiac so many times. I mean,
mm-hmm.
at first viewing, you think the screenplay, defies conventions of a three act structure and so forth. But the more you look at Zodiac, the more you realize that is probably one of the the tightest constructed scripts for a police procedural.
Yeah, it's a great script. So are you, when are you coming back for another round of DVD reviews?
Well, that's the other thing. Well, I guess probably in May, because I, speaking of Fincher, you know, Benjamin Button is
Criterion, right.
Is coming up, and so we should be getting our copies of that. You know, Jamie, obviously, you're still in the analog standard definition age, and with the,
send me the Blu-ray. I got the Blu-ray player, so send me the Blu-ray one.
But did you get a Blu-ray finally?
Yes, I have a LG Blu-ray player that you can download the Netflix on-demand movies, like from there, from the computer onto the.
Wow.
Yeah,
how is it so far?
Well, I haven't used the Netflix thing, but the picture for the Blu-rays is beautiful.
Hey, guess what the top rental in the history of Netflix is?
Yeah, Crash.
But,
which,
really?
You know, I think that's kind of a funny. I read that story, and I thought that was kind of cool.
I thought so, too. Paul Haggis said, I don't know why, and I don't believe that my movie was the best movie of that year, either.
Yeah. You know,
which is great. I started to like Paul Haggis.
Yeah,
Paul
Haggis, that's a very honest thing. That's a very cool
we
thing
got
to
we
say.
Got to get to our interview. Jason's prepared an interview for Jerry and I that we got to get to.
All right, guys.
All right.
Come back. Let's do DVD reviews again, and we're going to do the summer of '84. I decided.
During summer '84, so we're in the midst of that. So I just
want
to say
cool.
congrats, guys. I'm glad to be
Thank
a part
you.
Of it. I'll
you
talk
are,
to y'all
man.
Soon.
Thank you, buddy.
Bye.
Bye, dude. All right. Jason O'Brien, our good buddy, preparing this interview, slaving.
Jason, I just want to say it's an honor
yeah,
to have you on
away,
the show.
I tell you. I don't get a big intro, Jamie.
No,
I mean,
no, I just want to say it's an honor to have you on tonight.
Well, thank you, Jerry. That's,
I mean
that. That's better than any intro that I could ever have.
Okay.
Wow. All right, Jason. I appreciate you doing this. This was your suggestion. I thought it was a terrific idea. Because you're
well,
such a great, you have a great show of your own. You have wonderful interviewing skills, and I can't wait to hear what you got.
Oh yes. I've been looking forward to this. I've been, you know, slaving over this. And you know, I kind of feel like your elder, you know, because, you know, I had my two-year anniversary back in November, you know, so. It
well, I look
like
up to you,
but,
Jason. I look up to you, so.
You are but, our Yoda.
Well, I just, I wanted to mention that I, you know, I've outlasted Jamie, you know, so.
That's good.
Wow.
Sorry, just
okay.
had to get that in.
All right,
man,
well, let's get to the flattery.
A little bit ago.
He did. He was here a minute. That was very thoughtful of him.
Yeah, that was. He didn't stop by for my two-year anniversary, but.
Yeah, well, you know, he definitely wasn't alone. So are we getting to the interview portion?
Oh, yes. Well, first, congratulations on the 2 years, man. That's a good achievement.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you, buddy. Thank you.
You know, I've told you before that, you know, you guys have got a really, really great show, and I'm continually amazed at the level of the amount of the guests that you get on the show. Mm-hmm. So I kind of want to start, before we kind of talk, I know, you know, we wanted to focus on this past year. You know, I for me, like as a fellow Blog Talk Radio host, I'm always interested in, you know, hearing, you know, how shows kind of come together. So kind of going back to the beginning of it, you know, how did the show begin? Like, did you and Jerry and Aaron know each other before the start of this show? I mean, just kind of talk about how it came together.
Jerry, you take that.
Well, I'm going to say that Aaron, as you heard, Aaron didn't join us till I think, August or September of 2007. And what had happened was I had, because I was just, you know, surfing the net one night, and I saw that Jamie was going to be on the Dead Air show, another Blog Talk Radio show that I think you might be familiar with, Jason.
Mm-hmm.
I called in and we spoke about movies, about Oscar nominations.
Yeah.
And the next day, I get an email from John, one of the guys on the Dead Air show, and he's all over the place. And he says, you know, you and Jamie had a really great chemistry on the air. You guys should start your own show. And it sort of went from there. And Jamie, you know, sent me an email, and he got the same message from John, and we built from there. And Jamie really is the mastermind behind all of this, because that's the reason the show is a success, is because of his brainstorming and his ideas and everything. And he brought in Chris. Chris was another essential component of the show. And now he's in nursing school right now, and he works a lot. But when he was on, it was a lot of fun. And I do miss that, but, you know, it's just time constraints and everything. And he does come on. I think he is coming back. He's going to join us for a couple of Sundays.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But that's the, like, the Cliff Notes version.
Yeah, okay. And Jerry and I spoke at length prior, and I was very nervous. I didn't know how to work anything. I didn't know what to do. Our first episode was movies that make you want to vomit.
That was it. Our show was devoted to Grindhouse and movies that want to make you vomit.
I didn't have a house phone.
To start out with. Grindhouse was for the time a great movie to like launch the show with.
Mm-hmm. I didn't have a house phone, so I went to a recording studio and paid time to sit there for an hour and do my
really?
Show. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Didn't know that.
Yeah.
So
I'm
interested too in how. You know, who came up with the name, Movie Geeks United, and did you have alternate names that you were thinking of before that?
I can't think of any alternate.
I think we just settled on that. You had mentioned it on the phone, and I was like, sure, that's fine.
It was the first thing that came to mind.
Okay, it was just like something that hit you and was like a revelation.
Right.
I'm telling you, too, dude. Now I see, Movie Geeks isn't a new phrase, but now I see shows and websites all over the place with movie geeks on them.
There's
that's
another
right.
We are movie geeks that I've seen pop up in the last year or so, and things like that. So you do. I will say I've seen it a lot.
Right. So how much preparation tends to go into one of these shows? I think some people might be interested in like, you know, how much preparation like usually when you have you know say two or three guests a show. You know how and you know and as all of us like most of us blog talk radio hosts, you know we have daytime jobs. You know, so, you know, how much work actually goes into putting together one of these shows?
There's always a, obviously, if I have an author on like I did tonight, I have to read the book because I like to know what I'm talking about.
That is a good thing, yeah.
And to my shock and surprise, a lot of authors are shocked and surprised that I've read their book. Don't interviewers read the book before they interview you on it? I guess they don't usually.
A lot of them may not. Yeah.
I sometimes, if I can find a book in the bookstore, I'll buy it and read it.
Yeah, Jerry's done that many times. You do the resource search and everything so you can conduct an informed interview. I've gotten to a point now, I used to be very militant about it. I've gotten to a point now where I just kind of make a sloppy outline and the conversation goes wherever it will. But that comes from becoming more comfortable interviewing and conversing with artists. The tribute shows are pretty down pat though. Those are the most prepared shows that we do.
Yeah, they really are. We do a lot of. I do a lot of reading. I'll go look up old books and everything old. I'll go buy some books. I'll definitely go like especially for like the Schrader and De Palma shows. I went back and watched a lot of their old films. Especially, I think the De Palma film. I actually went out and bought every film I didn't have on DVD.
Yeah,
I actually just went out and bought it. I think I spent like a couple $100 on that show.
We were all primed and ready for that show. That was a great one. I was
nervous before the De Palma interview. I've never been that nervous for any. That was the big. It was very nerve wracking.
I remember Jerry saying, "I'm not ready to do De Palma yet." It's like learning to walk or something.
Yeah,
it
wasn't until he actually opened his mouth. But I was like, okay, this is going to go well. But before that, I was a nervous wreck. I called Jamie like a couple of times, like, dude, I'm shaking. I'm trembling.
I look at the release schedule. I send out invites every week, get the confirmation, check it out with a publicist, make sure that they have all the information. I prepare the interview, and then I market it as many places as I can on the web and market the archive. It's a long process. It's a joy to talk to most of the people. I don't think we've had many duds, but
not many.
The process
at all.
Around it can be very trying.
Okay, well, let's talk about this the second year, and you know, and again, you had a great group of guests. Was there anyone this year that you never expected that you know you would get as an interview, and you were thrilled to get?
I think there are a couple actually. There are a couple this year. I mean, obviously we have the MM at Walsh, we have James Reborn, but there are a couple of people that we've gotten that I'm always like, and it's really it centers around the Paul Schrader show, really. And I know that's still like the end of the first year going into the second year, but that's really the one where I tell people we have Jeff Goldblum, Dana Delaney, and people are just ecstatic.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, when you mentioned Dana Delaney, I mean, my God, people are just like, really?
Dana Wells Delaney?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they just go, they go nuts. I mean, that alone right there, more than any other name I mentioned.
Yeah.
That's
you know,
wow.
we've had good beginnings and good endings to our years. The end of the, yeah. So the end of the first year was Schrader. The beginning of the second year was Uwe Boll, which could have been more interesting. Yeah.
That was a fascinating show.
And the beginning of the end of this year was John Voight, and the beginning of our third year, Mehmet Wash.
Yeah.
So we're batting a thousand there. Uwe Boll was great, and I had wanted to submit a request to him previous, but I thought, do I really want to get in that much trouble? It sounds like it might be an uncomfortable conversation. But then he came out in a video saying that Clooney was an asshole.
Yeah, I know.
I said, we got to have this guy on.
Yeah.
And he agreed. He, like, wrote me. He writes in broken English, too, which is great. He wrote me and said, I will do show, tell me what, when. And so I let him know. I have a clip from Uwe Boll. You want to play it, or did you want to preface it with a question? Or?
Oh, no, that I was going to mention him, actually, cause since he was kind of the start of the second year. So
Here's Uwe Boll. Here's Uwe Boll. I'll keep all of our lines unmuted in case we want to
react. Oh, my God.
Uwe Boll.
Take Obama, for example. He said a few weeks ago, like, it's absurd that the people still have weapons in America and that they are so religious driven, right? And since he said that, he's excusing every day in public that he said that. But the reality is that he said the truth, and it's time to wake up and to tell the people, if it's fundamentalists, Muslims, if it's like Bible Belt, Jesus Camp people from the Middle West, it is time to say as a knowledge, educated person living in this century now, look, guys, you are wrong. There is evolution. There is Darwin. And it's not like if you're an ultra-Orthodox Jew running around with a fucking black head and a big beard and stuff coming down out of your hair. Like, it's your problem. You are retarded. You think the wrong things about the world. You are wrong. And we are scientific-driven and natural science-driven. And this is also not, we cannot explain everything, but we know what is wrong. And we know that what Bush thinks about the evolution and the people in Midwest America think in the Jesus camps, whatever, that they are wrong. And they shouldn't have any political power, and they shouldn't vote at all as long they think this kind of things, what is proven wrong. So, and I think we are living in a time where it's time to step up, to say about Bush, for example, look, the Iraq war is a money-driven war made by Halliburton, Dick Cheney, and Bush, in paid by the weapon industry. And they made everything up about weapons of mass destruction and connections Al-Qaeda, Saddam, to start that idiotic war to make more money for their buddies. And it's not something good that there are soldiers and everybody like McCain or whatever say every day, like, you work for your country in Iraq. No, it's wrong. It's wrong that they're in Iraq. And if you're a soldier in Iraq, you should pack your stuff and go home, because you shouldn't fight for people that make money on you. You are not fighting in Iraq for America. You're fighting because you are cheated in a war and you maybe lose your life there. Why? Because people want to get richer. So, and all that stuff, you know, and this is the point. Like, I studied economy, I studied literature. And to think because I did House of the Dead that I'm not so educated like a George Clooney if he makes a movie. I would bet with you that I'm way more educated and I read way more stuff about as George Clooney his whole life. You know, I'm a doctor of literature. And this is pissing me off, that I'm in a situation that I look like a retard from that guy's, written down from that guy's in the internet.
Well.
Okay, I got to say something. That interview, That interview is what put Obama over the top, okay? That, is the
that was the clincher for him.
Dude, that was better than any episode of Hardball, okay? Come on. I mean, Chris Matthews has nothing on us.
It was highly entertaining, and he had a very smart guy with an unfortunate career. But
unfortunate career, okay?
But that's what makes him so great to listen to. I mean,
he's great. I mean, I don't even think you have to put any drinks in that. I just think you just lined him up and boom.
Yeah, just completely unapologetic.
You are wrong.
You are wrong, Jerry. You are wrong.
Yeah, you need to do more of your impression of him because people in the chat like your impression of him.
Yeah.
If you think that George Clooney, if you think that I somehow, because I made House of the Dead, that I'm not as smart as George Clooney, you are wrong.
Great.
That is great stuff. But yeah, I mean, there were some really good guests this past year. I mean, thinking of, like, you know, Rutger Hauer was one.
That was a great interview.
Let me tell you.
That was another great interview.
Let me tell you about Rutger Hauer. I didn't expect this. He's the only guy, that guest, that has made me really uncomfortable.
The only one, huh?
Yeah, and I love Rutger Hauer, but I was like, is he trying to start something with me? And
yeah, I know. Yeah. He.
Let me play this clip and let you guys hear what I'm talking about. Let me see, Rutger. Oh, I don't have it. I'll get it. We'll play. We'll play the clip from Rutger. It's somewhere.
Okay. Because I remember when you were, you know, talking about that interview and trying to prepare and, you know, thinking that this was one that, you know, you were nervous about. So, yeah, if you can find that clip, that'll be great to hear.
I got it right here. I'll upload it. Yeah,
okay.
It was hysterical. He took me to, he was playing with me or something, and I actually called Jerry afterwards. And I said, was he trying to throw down with me? I didn't.
Yeah, I think he was. Never mind. But
with a very, he was calling from Amsterdam.
Yeah.
I can only imagine he had a drink or some substance in his hand.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, most likely.
Mm-hmm.
Even so, I mean,
it was a wonderful interview. But, you know, the other things, like Aaron was talking about, like a lot of the critics we had on, David Edelstein, Glenn Kenny, Matt Soloveitch, these are all great guys to have on. Those were actually, for me, a lot of fun to talk to these guys who read their work for years, if not decades. So I enjoyed that immensely.
I'll tell you when we get Rutger Hauer on, Jason. You can go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, and what I was going to say, too, besides those critics, you know, also when you get, you know, some of the lesser-known, you know, writers or cinematographers, you know, your cinematographer show,
that was great.
Past year.
And the composers.
And the composer show I was going to mention.
I mean, we had Terrence Blanchard. I mean, that was a wonderful interview.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and all the composers that we've had on, it's just been incredible.
Yeah,
we've had a lot of them, man.
Yeah.
It seems that we've gotten good with a publicity company. They rep all the composers, and so we constantly get composers. And you and I, all three of us, we love film music. And Jason, I know you're really rabid about film music.
Oh yeah.
So it's right up our alley, really.
Right.
Yeah, and it reminds me. I don't think this was in the second year, but like in the first year maybe when you had like some of the sound editors on. You know, it's just you can go on listening to them forever talking about. You know, their process and, you know, and to me it's always fascinating to hear from people, you know, in these other parts of the filmmaking industry that don't always get a voice, you know, and to understand their craft and, you know, learn about it. And that's what's been fascinating about a lot of the interviews you guys have done.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's a really fun part of the show to bring lesser known, well, not lesser known to us, but lesser known to the media.
Lesser known to the general public, yeah.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's a lot of fun, especially like the sound editors we have for the David Lynch tribute show. That was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I know that's the first year, but that was great.
Yeah. And I was thinking, you know, one of my other favorite, you know, moments this year, too, was the show where you had both John Voight and, you know, Burt Young in the same show.
Burt Young was the last
one.
That was
great.
And I was just overjoyed to talk to him.
Yeah, when you said he was going to be on the show, I mean, that was just one I was so looking forward to, you know, because growing up on the Rocky movies and, you know, and that's what I love when you get a chance to interview someone that's been in the industry so long, like a John Voight. You know, those people are always so fascinating to listen to because they go back to, you know, just a great heyday of movies. And
Let's play John Voight and Burt Young back to back. Now Burt Young is a little longer file because he was just too funny, but.
Mm-hmm.
Voight called me like 10 minutes before he wanted me to interview him, and it was a shock to me. this was something else. He's a very emotional guy. When I saw him at the festival, I mean, he teared up several times talking about Ashby and his lost cut of the film, of his 82 film that's coming out soon. And then Burt Young agreed to come on a couple of hours before the show. So this was a real kind of last-minute show. But here's Voight, now followed up by Burt Young.
It was lost until a year and a half ago, almost 2 years now, when a young Scottish writer by the name of Nick Dawson, who had fallen in love with Hal's work, and he was 26 years old, but quite a lot more mature than 26 years old would indicate.
Yeah.
And he called me up and he said, "John, I'd like to interview you. I'm doing a book on Hal Ashby. I'd like to get some of your insights." And I said, "I'd sure be delighted to talk about Hal." And then he showed up at one point, and he actually showed up. I mean, there's even another aspect to the story that's quite unique. And he said, he called me from San Francisco and said, "I'm in San Francisco." This was a couple of months after he talked to me initially, and he said, "You know, I'm up here in San Francisco. I'm coming down a couple of days." I said, "That's great." He said, "May I bring with me Hal's daughter?" And I didn't know he had a daughter. He said, "Well, he did have a daughter, and she was trying to get in touch with him during her lifetime. They almost met several times, but they never did meet. But it would be nice for her to hear her stories about her dad." I said, "Isn't that wonderful?" I said, "Look, I'm very sorry I didn't know about this, because I was close enough to Hal that I definitely would have been able to get them together. So let's have her come along. We'll have some fun." And they came, and she turned out to be this young woman, Lee Ashby McManus, and she's an older woman, and she's she's not a kid, and she's had a couple of children herself, and she's a terrific gal, and it would have been so nice for Hal to have had that connection, but there were reasons in his background why that would have been a difficult thing, and maybe the whole story may come out one day. But anyway, they came down and they started talking about how much they loved Looking to Get Out, and I asked Lee, "Why was it?" She said, "It's my favorite film." I said, "Why is it your favorite film?" She said, "Because I think the girl in it, the little girl at the end, who was played by Angelina Jolie as a little baby, 4 years old, was me." And I thought about it, and I said, "Yes, it's very possible that it was you." So I remember the discussions we had, and we were thinking of going with a little boy, but Hal wanted it to be a girl. And so I remembered those conversations. And then Nick Dawson said, "It's one of my favorite films as well." And I said, "Well, where did you see it, Nick? Did you see it in DVDs, or what did you see?" He said, "No, I saw the cut that he left UCLA." I said, "What?"
Yeah, and so how did you already got the part in Looking to Get Out at that time? Tell me about the script and your reaction to it when you first read it.
Well, it wasn't mainly it was John Voight. I knew him, of course, as an important actor and a decent type of guy, but I didn't know him personally. But I was working on MGM, a lot of MGM, on a movie of my own that I had written. And he walked across, and he walked straight at me, and he said, "Hi, I'm John Voight." I said, "Yeah, how are you?" He says, "I need an actor. I co-wrote this movie. I need an actor that can blow me off the stage to make it work." He said, "Would you work with me?" I said, "Yeah." And that's how I was hired.
Wow. Well, that's quite a pitch. Right
that
now.
Is.
I need you to blow me off the screen. Yeah.
As soon as I got out at UCLA, I told everybody I could find, "Would you believe this shit?"
That's great. And years later, do you, if few years ago. Do you receive a call from Mr. Voight about this unseen cut of Looking to Get Out?
Yeah, I hear from that pain in the ass every 3 or 4 years. Yeah, we truly care for each other.
Yeah.
But if I saw more than every second year, I'd be in shock. I run into him in Rome. He was playing the Pope. I had to run into him. There he is, dressed like the Pope, this Protestant guy. I think he's Jewish now. He's playing the Pope, all makeup on and everything. So I got a blessing from him, and it was good to see him. Can I tell you a funny, not a funny, a story?
Yeah, of course. Please.
About how he had been sick for a little while.
Yeah.
At the end, he wasn't working. And he never was a pushing type of man. I think he worked with a rock group to do something that was quite brilliant. But he wasn't doing any movies at the end of his life, and he was sick. And nothing was working. And he was brought home to his place in Malibu, and his friends were trying everything, crystals and candles and
yeah.
Everything. And this might sound like a self-aggrandizement for me, but it wasn't. I don't mean it that way. But I went out to see him, and he was looking shaggy, you know, his beard was shaggy. He had on disheveled, you know, like the farmer's overalls with the straps around his shoulder. And he was laying in bed, and I laid down next to him. I said, I asked him, is he scared, you know? He says, yeah, Bert. And I just laid there with him for about 20 minutes. Not much I could say. And I went home, and honestly, I had a dream in the morning. And Hal was sparkling clean and shaved and in bright new overalls. And he was beaming like the sunshine. And they called me about 10 in the morning, told me he died.
Oh.
And that's a fact.
Wow. His, what do you think his legacy is? For moviegoers that are just coming into his films, what do you hope they take from Ashby and his work?
Well, I'd say complex literature done clearly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How's that sound?
That sounds very good.
That sounds good to me.
I think that sounds good to me, too.
Hang on. I'm going to write that down. I'm going to use that.
Okay.
Yeah. Before I let you go, I want to ask you one question about your art. And we're going to put up the website on our show here. You are a remarkable artist. Your website is BertYoungArtAndFilm.com. Just magnificent work. When did this start for you, and what do you enjoy about that process?
Well, I'm really good.
That's the most awesome thing. Yeah, there you go.
And modest. That's what I love.
No, dude, it's beautiful. I love it.
And very modest.
Bert Young, yeah.
That was great.
Yeah, he's a great guy. And I saw him in person, and he's just, the audience just loved him the second he walked downstage for the Q&A at the end of the film. He got a chair. John Voight started talking, so he pulled up somebody's chair and sat on it. He said, I'm going to be here a while. He goes on and on and on. And they're great together. My God, they have a remarkable chemistry. They really love each other.
Yeah. It's great stuff.
Yeah.
Did you get that Rutger Hauer clip uploaded now?
I got it. You want to hear Rutger Hauer? The Rutger Hauer throwdown? Even Jerry comes to my defense. Jerry tries to save me here, but... No one can do anything.
Yeah, it's,
the Hitcher
you know,
is absolutely one of my favorite.
Hang on. This is about the Hitcher.
Yeah.
Any day now it'll start. Okay.
The Hitcher is absolutely one of my favorite films of that genre, just because it's so down and dirty and kind of relentless. Mm. And But I had a different kind of view of how you portrayed the character from when I read your book and read your take on it. I thought that you probably it was a role that didn't require you to find the humanity in it. But you had a very...
You're right.
Is that correct, or do you have a different take on that character?
Are you asking me if it was a role that can you be a little more precise, and I'll answer it precise?
Well, because a lot of times characters, when they play so-called villains, they search to find the humanity in the character, and I thought that this was a different kind of role.
Okay, in what way?
Well, an unstoppable force.
Are you saying you didn't feel the humanity?
I thought that the character represented an unstoppable force, and that's what he was.
Right.
The
force of what? I'm interviewing you now.
Yeah.
The force of what?
Like an unstoppable, like a Terminator almost, just an unstoppable killing machine.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to take that away from you. It sounds fine. I play every character as humane as I can come up with. And it doesn't matter, you know, what the character is. I play characters, I play people, basically.
Yeah.
And some people are really mean and others are not, you know. So I thought he was charming. I thought he was one of the most charming men I would meet on the road.
Yeah.
All right, was that laughter our laughter right now? Or was that we weren't laughing like that during the interview, were we?
There was some laughter during the
interview.
I know
there was some, but was that you guys laughing?
No, I was laughing at... Yeah, we were laughing at him trying to give it back to me.
That's one of my favorites, because I'm trying to picture, you know, Jamie. You know, was your heart, like, racing right about then?
Yes. Yes. I'm not a confrontational person. Everything came out wrong for me, that show. Everything could be misinterpreted.
Yeah.
He said, how long do we have? I said, I know this is a long-distance phone call. You know, I don't want to keep you very long, meaning I didn't want to take too much of his time or his money or his dime. He thought I was saying, I don't want to spend that much money on a long call. So he said, oh, you'll live. I was like...
That's right.
And then when I exhaled, then when he said, an unstoppable force, you didn't find the humanity in the character? And I went... It wasn't frustration with him. It was, I don't want to tell this guy I didn't find humanity in his character.
You were afraid of what the next answer would be.
Yes.
That's good stuff.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
But yeah. Now, one of my other favorite memories, and I hope you can play this, because if anybody didn't hear this, you know, one of the things that I think is so great about your show and, you know, all of us who do shows that, you know, we're obviously not getting paid for this. You know, this is something that we're so passionate about. When we can passionately speak about movies, you know, and one in particular I remember brought you to tears on the show. And now was that the first time that had happened on the show, Jamie?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Before the show, I've been brought to tears by not being able to log in or something.
Yeah, that's bad. I'm just brought to tears whenever I hear my own voice. I just cry like I can't believe that's me. My God. Why don't I have a voice like Robert Mitchum?
I think for Jerry and I both, this defines what draws us to the show, the fact that all three of us here, all three of us on the line here, you included, Jason, we're very passionate, like you said, about movies, and they mean a lot to us. It's not about fandom or any of that nonsense.
It's not.
Right.
I think we need to really emphasize it's really not about fandom at all.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a kind of long clip, but it needs to play to get to know that I'm not like an absolute crybaby. There's a reason behind it. This is like self-confession here. This is me reviewing with Jerry Vicky Cristina Barcelona, which was my favorite movie last year.
I will say that it's the most personal for me. It's the only Woody Allen movie I've ever walked out on and sobbed. If you could tell what you thought of it first, because it's an emotional movie for me.
Well, I was not expecting. You have caught me off guard. Folks, ladies and gentlemen, this is live radio. As I've said many times before, anything can happen. this makes those live episodes of Benny Hill look like child's play. Okay.
No, it's impossible for me to review it without being personal with it.
No, that's fine. There is something very personal, and I would like to, first of all, even before I start talking about this film, I did want to answer a question you asked me a long time ago about Woody Allen and who would be his cinematic heirs.
Mm.
And we had said, I believe in the conversation, Wes Anderson and, to a lesser extent, Noah Baumbach. But while watching this movie,
sure.
Whit Stillman would be who made Barcelona.
Possibly.
And
yeah.
Metropolitan, I would think, Alan, even more so than anyone else, maybe.
Really, you know, there's some comparisons in terms of how he draws the relationships between men and women, and no matter what happens in his personal life, whatever controversy surrounds that,
yeah.
I think he understands it more than that. Like it said in the trailer, the contradictions,
right?
The ambiguities, you know,
yeah.
to male female relationships. It's stunning.
Yeah, it is, and there's something in this film, you know. I think, I don't know where you put this, because I don't put this in the tragedies like Cassandra's Dream or Match Point.
Right.
And I don't put this in the comedies that have come, well, especially not Scoop or Melinda and Melinda. I don't know where to put this one, because I think it's the most honest he's ever been. I think, for me, the film really comes to life when Penelope Cruz's character enters the film. I mean, she's
like a shot in the arm.
Yeah, she just comes in. And folks, you know, I know a lot of people don't have a high opinion of Penelope Cruz, but I don't care if you saw Vauvert, you should have an incredibly high opinion of her.
She's one of the finest actresses we have.
Yeah, and Woody Allen finds what's so incredible about her, and her presence, like you said, a shot in the arm. Javier Bardem and her, the relationship they have in this film, or lack of one, and they're explaining that to Scarlett Johansson's character, I think that's the most honest Woody Allen's been in a very long time about relationships. Didn't you get that impression that this is the most, he's like really stripped himself?
Yeah.
It's the first time in a long time.
I think, you know, I think religious people have a problem with Woody Allen because he's a self-announced atheist, and a lot of those views come out in his movies, like
mm-hmm.
Match Point and so forth. But they don't find any as a result, because their morality is defined by their religion. They don't find any
right.
morality in his works, and it's the complete opposite.
Yeah.
I think they're some of the most moral works of any director, because he says if he accepts that there is no God, and I don't share these views, but if he accepts that, and, you know, the world is a rotten place, blah, blah, blah,
mm-hmm.
it takes that extra special something, that extra special push to be kind to one another, to lead a good life,
right.
to make good moral decisions. He finds that hopeful, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's much of that in a lot of his movies, Match Point. It's in there. It's in Cassandra's Dream.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that I do feel a real awakening in Woody Allen. I think he has become, in these past efforts, a true international director. Not just because he's shooting elsewhere, but because he finds his muse in each of these different locations.
Right.
I mean, his writing, and it amazes me how he writes so fast. He got
does.
Barcelona. Barcelona's paid up money. They said, we want you to shoot out here. There, he came out with an idea. And it comes from his television days, where he had to write scripts on the fly
right.
for all these different situations. It's one of the most, first of all, menage a trois or not, it's one of the most romantic movies I've seen. Because these people, I mean, they truly love and respect one another, you know, and you feel that. I love his dialogue. He uses a narrator again in this one. And sometimes the narration is a little too, you know, it's Woody Allen. It's very literate.
Right.
Sometimes the narration is used in places where it shouldn't be. But I enjoy the sound of his dialogue. I enjoy that kind of brainy,
mm-hmm.
brainy inner thought, you know, that
right.
the narrator's basically, yeah. And the actors are so good. I mean, talk about a perfectly cast movie. There's not a weak link in this movie. And they're all so vivid. What struck me was, you know, I got out of high school. I hung around all that artsy crowd. I was inspired by them and kind of fed off each other. It was such an exciting environment. I could have gone off to New York or Hollywood or what have you, and my dreams could have come true. But part of it was too scared. A lot of it was I didn't want to leave my family behind.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, it's likewise. So, and you got that from watching this. Through the Scarlett Johansson character? Jamie.
Yeah, it's in the whole thing.
Okay, dude, it's cool. It's cool. I'm with you here, so don't worry. Folks, I'm going to interject because Jamie has actually had the balls to actually say something that's been on my mind probably for 6 or 7 years, and he's being very honest, and it's something I think about a lot, and he's just more brave in vocalizing it. And this is why I am very grateful to do the show with him, because we both come from the same place in this regard. And he has just been, and I'm just like really flabbergasted in the last 2 minutes, said something that's been on my mind for years. So we'll let him take his time to get his...
I mean, you and our listeners, we're all family. And yeah. I want to be emotional because...
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, my God, that's why we love movies.
Yeah.
I just feel like, you know, I felt that longing to live a vivid life.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, I've had a great love in my life, and it's been 7 years since we were together. I think about her every day. And that kind of love was so passionate, and I think back on it like what I saw in this film.
Mm-hmm.
These are people that make mistakes, but they're awake. You know, they're fully alive. And there's such romanticism and beauty in that. And, you know, obviously everyone carries their own baggage to a movie like we discussed in one of the last shows. But that, damn it, that's the beauty of movies.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that what I see in that movie isn't there. It is there explicitly for me.
Mm-hmm.
I think the women, Woody Allen writes women that are so sharply drawn.
Mm-hmm.
He is the best writer of female characters out there. He has been for many. That's most of that conversation there.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was powerful stuff. I mean, that was a powerful
just listening
episode.
To it.
I mean, no doubt.
Yeah, just listening to it again.
It
you know, I hadn't remembered actually that, you know, Jerry, you did such a great cover. You know, realizing, you know, that Jamie was very choked up at
mm-hmm.
that moment. You know, and it just the honesty between you two guys.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's what, you know, kind of what we said before that clip was that, you know, a lot of people, you know, and thank God for the internet because, you know, people like Shelley, you know, the three of us and, you know, a lot of us, you know, able to connect because we don't know a lot of people around us that can understand, you know, this level of passion
mm-hmm.
that we have,
I would
you know,
say
for movies.
Everyone who's in the chat room now, everyone who's been in the chat room tonight all together, I mean, these are all people that we've connected
yeah.
with the show and outside the show, and they've been very, you know, we all understand one another.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
I think that was the crying aside, I think that was what great film conversation should be.
Right.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, when you can. Yeah. I mean, when we get into discussions like that, when you can get, you know, to. I mean, these are what movies are for. I mean, you know, to evoke some kind of emotion, you get so deeply involved in it like that. I mean, that's what great movie discussion is.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know.
Yeah.
And to and be able to share that with someone else, you know.
Can we play something funny now?
Yeah, I was just going to lead into that because I wanted to balance to kind of lift our spirits. I was going to say that, you know, I've mentioned this to you over the past year. Your bravery in taking phone calls during interviews.
I do.
One of the most admirable things I've ever seen because you know I don't do that many interviews on my show, but I couldn't imagine actually ever taking calls during an interview, you know, because it's such a, you know, and a minefield that you don't know what you're going to get. But, you know, you've had some interesting callers over this past year.
It's like Russian roulette, except there's only one blank in the thing. All the other chambers are loaded. So you just don't know what you're going to get. I extracted two callers.
Okay.
One was, I think, the best from the first year and then the best with the second year.
Is this going to be the Dana Delaney one?
No, no.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, wait, is this the one where we had...
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
The first one is in relation to the star of Saw 4 came on.
Oh, this is one of the great...
Oh, I may have heard this one.
He was postponed. The guest was postponed for a night. This guy is a rabid Saw fan. He's a kid. He actually made a YouTube video of him calling up. So he had two nights to think of this question.
Man, you are so cold.
I am surprised that these people remember to breathe. The second person called for, it'll come to me, Brian Bertino, the director of The Strangers. That hard
movie.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. So here's back-to-back callers. This is great.
Let me take another caller real quick. I think this is the biggest Saw fan in the world, actually.
Okay.
he was calling in last night.
Okay, so cool.
Let's take his call now. 717 area code. You are on the air. You got a question for Lyric?
Hi. I hear you're the biggest fan. What do you got for me?
I am. I've been looking forward to this day since last night, and ever since actually I heard about it.
All right, cool. Glad to have you here.
You want to know anything about the new Saw?
Yeah. This might be a dumb question, but in the trailer, like when you get tackled or something, was that you or?
Yeah, that was me.
Did that hurt?
Okay, let me bring up 703. 703, are you with us?
Yes.
Hello? 703. Hey, 703, go right ahead. Do you have a question?
Am I live?
Yes, you're live. Do you have a question?
You're live. You on? I didn't know I was on. Okay, I have a question. Okay. Oh my God, I didn't even know that was really me. That is so cool. I'm sorry. Okay.
It's my first time being on live stuff too, so
we're all nervous.
Yeah, we're all first day on the job.
Go ahead, 703. What do you got for us?
Okay, I'm really hyped to see this movie. Like, I really am, and like, I want to know, is it like really boring in the beginning, and then it gets scary, or is it like just scary?
Oh my God.
I
love the audacity of this question.
I like to think it's awesome the entire movie, but
I think it sounds like 80 minutes of nonstop awesome film. So
I love that, Jerry. Oh my God, he couldn't contain it.
That's just great. And what I love, and Shelley mentioned this in the chat, it is like that Chris Farley skit on SNL. You know, when you got knocked down, did it hurt? That's great stuff. Yeah,
I'll keep taking calls. I mean, a lot of times I regret it, but honestly, it's so entertaining, and you get the live show sense when you take calls. You know?
Yes, you do. I mean, it does bring you back to the old days of live shows. You know, when you felt like anything could happen. You know, and I don't think we'll ever see that again, except for someplace like internet radio.
Yeah.
You know, because we have 7-second delays on TV, and you know, so it's such a great thing. But
we're thinking of doing a show where all we do is take calls, and we're going to rename the show The Dumbing of America.
Something there, yeah. I mean, but I only want to ask, did that hurt?
Hurt?
Did that hurt? I mean, I forgot.
Two nights to think about that.
Well, you know, it takes
That's
a long
scary.
Time. I mean, you know, you got to come up with something. And, I mean, maybe to him that was, like, the most important pressing question of the day. Or the 2 days. It
might
was.
Have been. I don't know. Jeez. Yeah.
Oh,
but
and another foot. I played through Paul Schrader the other night. And Paul Schrader says, now you can download your own music online and your own homemade pornography online. I said, well, God knows I do both. Schrader started laughing.
Wait a second. Paul Schrader, that's right, Paul Schrader, the whole thing about pornography. Yeah, and I was like, I think I wanted to ask him, wait, do you do that too? I mean...
No, he makes those into feature films.
Yeah, I know. Is there a special cut of The Comfort of Strangers we haven't seen? Or, I mean, is there a special The Closer? I mean, come on.
Yeah, The Comfort of Strangers, really comforting.
Yeah, very, very little comfort in that.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so thinking back over, you know, 2 years of the show, You know, one question I wanted to ask, and this one actually is inspired by Siskel and Ebert way back in 91, 92. They did an interview show with George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, and Martin Scorsese.
I remember that show.
Yeah, and they asked, one of my favorite questions that they asked each of them was, if you had to pick one image, you know, from all of your films that really sums up you, you know, who you are as a filmmaker, you know, what image would you pick? And, you know, Spielberg picked the image of the little boy opening the door in Close Encounters, you know, the wonderment of what's out there, you know, kind of sums up his work. You know, so kind of in thinking of, you know, over 2 years of achieving, you know, what you have on this show, if you had to pick, like, one moment or one achievement, you know, that kind of came out from the show that, you know, is your most proud or, you know, would say represents what you really always want to achieve with the show, you know, what would each of you pick?
Go ahead, Jerry.
Oh, thanks. Put me on the firing line, man. Now, I want to say something before I get to that, because I have a pretty good idea what it is. My thing for this, to do this show, is always, I always wanted to make it like a cross between Terry Gross's Fresh Air on NPR and Tough Crowd with Colin Quinn. If you can swallow that combo,
yeah,
that was too extreme.
Sure, Colin, I'm sure Terry Gross could swallow that.
Hey, I listen to her every day. She's wonderful. But those two screams, those two kind of things, the humor from the Tough Crowd, but also, like, I think Terry Gross is one of the best interviewers out there. I think she's incredible. Okay, having said that, we got to go back to the Paul Schrader show where we interviewed him and then the two other directors that night, because I think that represented a generational thing. You have Paul Schrader coming on talking about, like, basically the end of going to the movie theater, but then you had these two other guys, one the director of Married Life and then a much younger director with his first film, and you got to forgive me, I don't remember his name. But they spoke about the joy of watching the movie in a theater and about how important that was. Like, these guys weren't giving up on the movie-going experience, and I found that very refreshing. But what I also liked about this show, I think it was the first show I was not nervous for after a year. It was very nervous, very, like, grinding the teeth before each show. And that one, I was surprisingly down to earth, like, just ready. And
I was still very nervous for that one until he started talking. I'm like you, Jerry. I got through a phase where I was really nervous before every guest until I knew that they weren't a jerk
right
when they opened their mouth, you know.
And I must have read so many things that Sunday before we interviewed him. I read, like, every article he had written, Paul Schrader, and then I read a lot of interviews and a lot of sketches on him, and I'm, like, thinking, okay, I know this guy's films. I know this. And he came on. He was, like, really, really nice individual. And this is a very interesting conversation. And I think the other thing that we do is we don't do these kind of, like, standard Q&As. We really do try to have conversations.
Mm-hmm. It really started with that one, too, for me, in terms of conversation. Because he threw us a bone with Movies Are Dead.
Yeah.
That was just too good not to follow up on. So it became that piece of that exchange is probably my favorite in our history. In terms of personal for me, to give you a sense of how passionate we are about movies, it would be that Vicky Cristina.
Right.
In terms of interviews, how passionate we are about artists. There's one very special interview for me, which is Raymond J. Berry, that I always bring up.
Oh, yeah.
He was really nervous coming on, because he never does interviews, but he's in, like, Year of the Dragon and Dead Man Walking and Born on the 4th of July and great works. As soon as we started to engage him about acting, he was our best friend.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, he was like, I really enjoyed this, guys. That's what I loved. I loved doing that. There was one this year with Mark Damon, who was a producer, who produced a lot of movies, a colorful career, discovered by Groucho Marx, and then went into producing, and then produced 9½ Weeks, and introduced Sergio Leone to Clint Eastwood. I mean, this guy's got an epic life. And I actually got this clip. We'll close the show with it in a few minutes, but where he talks about how terrible Mickey Rourke is as a human being.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
That was a particularly satisfying interview because we had a joke going on where I called him Mr. Damon. He said, "Don't call me Mr. Damon. Call me Sir Damon or what have you." And that was very funny. So he wrote me a thank you letter afterwards, and he said this was a top-notch interview, like the best I've ever had. Thank you so much. And he signed it Emperor Damon because we had an ongoing joke. That was really satisfying. But let me take a call real quick, Jason. I don't want to break your stride. This is the bravery
kind of fits
coming
in with
out.
The bravery of taking callers, you know.
Yeah. Is this the Saw guy? I got a 516 area code.
Hey, how you doing? No, I don't know who the Saw guy is. My name is Jesse from Long Island. How you guys doing?
Hey, Jesse, what's up, man?
Good. Everything's good. Just enjoying your conversation. I just wanted to say that I seen Adventureland, and wow, what a great movie!
It's the best movie of the year.
You agree with me, right?
I think it's one of the single-handedly best coming-of-age films I've seen in many, many, many years.
You know the kind of feel I got? I felt like I was watching, oh, man, the name's escaping me right now, with Billy Crudup and Jason Lee, where he's the rock and roll artist.
Yeah, almost famous, yeah.
Almost famous.
Yeah, I'll put it to you, I think it's the best coming-of-age film since The Graduate.
Oh wow!
It is. I think it's incredible. I will definitely stand up for this film. It's a shame that it has not found a wider audience. It was marketed horribly, but it is an incredible film.
And that's why I wanted to call you guys. I didn't mean to change the subjects on you.
That's quite all right.
But I just seen the film yesterday, and
mm-hmm.
The marketing for it was so bad. They're trying to market it as a
That's another super bad.
And I went with a friend of mine that, I mean, he doesn't have the same appreciation for movies that I do. And his kind of outtake is, this movie's not a comedy. What's wrong with this movie? And I'm like, are you kidding me? This movie's great. I mean,
yeah.
It's not what you expected, but it's even better.
That's right. It's much better. It's actually kind of, think about it, it's kind of in some ways very bleak in some regards. The parents, we were talking about this yesterday because my brother went to see it, and the parents, her parents especially, her father is like excrement in human form.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's just a waste of space. The parents in the movie, like in a lot of these movies, are really beaten down, disposable people. But it's an incredible film, and I strongly would recommend it to anyone.
Yeah, thanks for calling in, buddy. I appreciate it. We're about 8 minutes away, so I have to end the call.
Oh, yeah, no, I understand.
Yeah. See? They're taking callers, Jason.
Yes. Yeah. The bravery continues, yes.
That was one of the loaded chambers. So.
Yes, absolutely. But, I mean, he's absolutely right. I mean, then it's great to talk about another movie, you know, that
yeah.
Did you see it yet, Jamie?
No, I didn't. I've seen a movie called Adventureland, but it wasn't that one.
God. Yeah, because Jerry's absolutely right. I mean, he had me really pumped to go see that movie. And
I'm glad I could do that.
I was pumped
to
see My Adventureland, too.
Yeah, I bet you were. All right, so one last question. Just, you know, thinking ahead to, your third year now beginning, you know, is there still that dream guest, and besides Al Pacino, that you'd really, really like to get on the show?
Yes.
And maybe that you think that you could actually really get to.
Yes.
Okay.
Are
you going to reveal that?
I'm going to, well, that we could get or that we, a dream guest.
Well,
both.
I'll reveal three that I'm really close to getting.
Okay.
Because I've been stalking them forever. Harrison Ford.
You're close to getting him?
I feel it. I communicate with his. I communicate with his personal assistant. She likes me. We have a good communication.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of the other two. I'm sorry, Stallone.
Oh, another good
for
one.
Expendables.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a third one, and it's escaped me. But I'd love to get actually Adrian Lyne. I'd love to spend an hour talking to Adrian Lyne.
That would be great.
Yeah, Jerry. What about you?
Clint Eastwood, Michael Mann, and Quentin Tarantino.
Nice.
Yeah. And I think they're all doable.
Hmm.
Not like that. Get your mind out of the fire, Val.
That's Adventureland Part 2.
Yeah, I know, really. That is Adventureland Part 2.
Wow.
Man.
Jason, buddy, thank you for this.
Thank you, Jason.
Well,
it's always a pleasure. But I need to say something before we go. The show that we did, the three of us did the roundtable on Oliver Stone's W, was another highlight
of
the second year. That was a great show. That was an incredible show.
Yeah.
And I loved when we've done the kind of the Oscar discussions, you know, when
mm-hmm.
we were kind of on each other's shows, you know, pretty much throughout Oscar season.
Yeah, those are great.
Know,
those roundtables
are
great.
Those are great.
Yeah, those are so much fun to do.
And
yeah,
I actually had a clip of Toby Jones talking about playing Rove in W. I won't play it, but he talked about how he played Karl Rove, and he said, I always look at Rove, and it's like he's listening to his own private circus music. He's got, he's got this bemused smile on his face. It was a great insight.
But yes, and I'll just wrap up by saying that, you know, I just think I speak for a lot of the people that, you know, have been fans of your show, that, you know, I've always been amazed at the continual amount of guests that you get, you know, and just as a fellow, you know, movie fanatic, you know, to hear a couple guys talking about movies as passionate as you guys do, I mean, that's just, that's best as it gets with, for someone like me.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, buddy. I want you to sit in some of these interviews, too. Will you do that?
Yeah.
Do what now? I'm sorry.
I'd like you to sit in on some of these interviews, too.
And
would
participate.
You do that?
Because we had we had you on the line for one interview, and you were on the line, but you didn't say a word. And I was like, where's Jason?
Well, I'm always, you know, Jamie does so much preparation for these, you know, so I always feel like I'm going to throw off his, you know, focus if I like, throw in a question or something.
Right. No. You got a lot to say. No.
You know, just...
So, hey,
if
you get Stallone, I definitely want to sit in for that because, I mean, God, talk about an icon from my youth.
Oh, yeah.
You will be able to sit on that. Just don't ask him if it hurt when he got tackled in the trailer.
Wait, that was my premier question.
Because he gets tackled in every trailer.
Well, that's true.
All right, we're going to close off with a clip of Mark Damon, producer extraordinaire, talking about Mickey Rourke and the experience of 9.5 weeks. A little gossipy clip for you. And actually, they're in the middle of a lawsuit now with Bruce Willis. That's a little hush-hush. I shouldn't say that.
Wow, okay.
what a way to introduce this clip.
Breaking news.
We'll be back Sunday with M. Emmett Walsh. The filmmakers of a new horror movie called Laid to Rest.
Oh,
and
cool.
We'll have Chris here with us, and it'll be a good time. We'll bring up some topics in the news. It'll be a loose-form conversation. Jerry, Jason, thank you, buddies.
Hey, thank
Absolutely.
You. And thanks to everyone for making it 2 years. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely, guys. You guys are awesome out there. Here's Mark Damon. Good night, everybody. Mr. Damon, I want to ask you about one film in particular.
Don't call him Mr. Damon. Call me Sir. Sir, or Your Highness.
Sir Damon.
Emperor.
Emperor, that's better.
Right. This is a film that I've always loved. And as I've matured, the meaning of the film has matured for me. And I know you have mixed feelings about it, and that's 9.5 weeks. And I'm reading this chapter on the production of this film was of particular interest to me, and I'm wondering if you can give our audience just a little taste of how problematic that shoot was and what your thoughts on that film are today.
Well, I don't have mixed feelings about the end product. The only one I had, I thought maybe we could have made a film that was slightly more erotic, but then maybe it would not have carried the same impact if we had gone a little overboard on the eroticism. I think, you know, people today say the film is highly erotic and set the sexual standards for the world in the 80s and so, you know, who am I to argue with what feels like a great success? I don't think any director or producer is ever 100% happy with a film. But, and you're right, it's the test of time. People who see that film today do not feel it's dated, which I think is great. The problem is, though, is guiding everyone to the finish line.
Right.
And we had a particularly difficult problem because we had two actors who absolutely hated each other, and yet they come off on screen as the most romantic love story ever told. Mickey was absolutely frightening in how he handled Kim Basinger. I'm talking about Mickey Rourke.
Yes.
And she was so frightened of him and eventually of the role she was playing that I often would have to go into her trailer in the morning and sit with her for a couple of hours while she was coiled in the fetal position saying, I can't, please don't make me, I can't come out, I can't act, I can't do it. And finally I would coddle her and tell her how great she was, and she really was great in the movie, and then try both of us to face Mickey and also a director, Adrian Lyne, who was kind of supporting Mickey in the way he was handling Q him because he thought that they were really getting to her and getting the kind of performance that was needed. But there are ways to do it, and I thought that if I ever got through this film, I would like to kill Mickey Rourke afterwards, and I've had that feeling for the last 30 years, I think. he was very difficult and impossible, to say the least, to work
yeah.
with. But at any rate, doesn't matter what happens behind the scenes, and those are always fun things to talk about afterwards. All that matters is what's on the screen. We in that movie, and I don't recall whether I wrote this or not, but Mickey Rourke had a totally odd idea of what his character should be. Mm. And when we first put the picture together and saw the 4-hour and 40-minute cut, Mickey came off so badly, he was a sicko. He was absolutely unappealing. And when we first screened the picture for audiences, they hated it. They would throw things at it. In motion picture research screenings, in order to know that you have a successful picture, you should have 80% or more of the audience who say the picture is excellent or very good. But we had maybe 7% of the audience who said it was excellent or very good, and about 80% who said they absolutely hated it. And that was because of Mickey's performance. Mickey saw his role in a certain way and was intent on coming across that way as this psychopath, which worked totally against the movie because you want to love him because he loves her. And so we reconstructed his performance frame by frame. We would take moments, for example, after Adrian Lyne would say cut and Mickey would giggle, we would grab that and put a little giggle somewhere. Where he would smile because he thought the camera wasn't on him, we would pick that up. We restructured his performance totally. And when he saw the movie, I'm sure he didn't recognize himself at all in it because he was lovable. Mm. And Mickey Rourke is not.
There it is. Mickey Rourke is not lovable. All right, Jerry.
All right.
Thank you, man. You have a
Thank
good night.
Thank you. You too.
See you Sunday.
Sunday for the big one.
Yeah, it's going to be a good one.
All
Thank
right.
you, my
have
friend.
Have a good one, guy. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.